Ms. Wright, before you begin, let me make a couple of announcements. Judge Griffith is with us by phone this morning. And Judge Griffith, are you there?
I am here.
Great. Okay. And then the second thing is, Judge Griffith joins me in welcoming our newest colleague, Judge Srinivasan, and we both hope to spend many years in happy service with you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Lisa Wright for Mr. Payton. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Payton entered a conditional plea of guilty to possession of drugs found during a warrantless search of his apartment and to a gun found in a second warrantless search conducted at the time of his arrest for the drugs. The plea specifically reserved his right to appeal his Fourth Amendment claims, and he has appealed several of them, challenging the legality of the police entry into the apartment in July initially, the voluntariness of his great-great-grandmother's July consent, and the adequacy of the findings thereon, the grandmother's lack of authority to authorize the search of the private area where the drugs were discovered, and the gun status as poisoned fruit of these illegalities. And we hope all those claims are clear in the briefs and, of course, welcome questions, but yes.
How would the police know that this area was a private area? The shoebox didn't have any initials. It wasn't said, it wasn't marked, do not open, anything like that?
I believe, you know, the affidavit does say that she told the police that that was the area where he kept his belongings, and it was a bed.
And he slept there.
Yeah, they knew that it was that two people lived there, and it was a one-bedroom apartment, and that this day bed, what they called a day bed, was you know, clearly the other bedroom. And she specifically directed them there as that was his area.
Right. Did she also say he keeps his clothes here, or?
I think what they said was that she said that was where he kept his belongings. He went to the back of the bed in the apartment's living room. Ms. Hicks identified this as the area where Mr. Payton keeps his personal property.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is, according to this drawing, I don't know what these numbers mean. 3 and 4. Are the living room, I assume, which is the bed and the shoebox, but then 1 and 2 look to be the closet and the bedroom. And do you know what 1 and 2 signify? I mean, did they look in that closet?
I looked at that yesterday. I think that that drawing has to do with stuff taken during a different search. I think that is from...
Oh, okay. So we just look at it for the...
I think it was attached to a return of a warrant or something. I'm not positive about that. I find those numbers confusing as well, but they were in the apartment many times. Perhaps the government understands it.
Okay,
that particular point.
We're just supposed to use it as the layout of the apartment rather than.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing they're using it for.
Okay,
is my understanding.
Okay.
I do want to focus on the lack of authority argument, and the most important point I think is that the burden is on the government to show that Ms. Hicks had common authority over the place where the contraband was found, or that it reasonably appeared that she did, and here neither is true with respect to the contraband found in the shoebox by the bed.
Do we know where it was relative to the bed? There's suggestions in the record that it was near the bed. Do we have any details on what that means?
Well, of course, defense counsel did try to ask specifically about where things were located, so that was precluded, but the affidavit says went to the area. I believe that one of the officers did testify it was, quote, by the bed, on the floor by the bed. I mean, I don't think there was a distance given or anything like that. I know there wasn't a distance given in this record.
There's no question, I take it, that it was amongst his personal property. Is that right? Is there any dispute over that?
Not that I know of. I mean, I think that's why they were there, is because they were told that was his personal property. The record is that that was essentially his bedroom. The government tries to say that, and the court sort of assumed that because she could physically access it, and I think the government's asking this court to make the same assumption, that because she could legally perhaps access that room or physically access that room, that is the end of the...
Well, that's the only way into the kitchen, and the bed, or the day bed, wasn't the only piece of furniture. Right.
There is not really a lot of testimony about
the common area.
The furniture. Well, I don't know that in the way this apartment was used, that is true. Of course, in a normal one-bedroom apartment, the living room is a common area for people that share the bedroom. But here, this was his bedroom. So I don't think without inquiry, it's quite ambiguous. If she had actual use of it as opposed to legal access or physical access, which is all the district court focused on.
Was there any evidence that she stayed totally in her bedroom? I don't think that's right.
Well, there was. I think the government's own opposition says she spent much of her time. They conceded she spent much of her time in there. She was, fairly disabled.
Right.
And I think that it's not a situation, for example, where you might assume, given her age and her physical situation, that she was in there cleaning or putting laundry away, or frankly, that she could even physically get down to the floor to get to that box. In that sense, it's almost as if it was inaccessible.
The consent form for the search referred to all the premises, though, didn't it?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
The consent form that Ms. Hicks signed for the search, didn't it refer to the entire premises of the property, suggesting that she was asserting authority over the whole premises?
Well, actually, on the first one, yes, she signed that written form, but the district court actually suppressed the search of the kitchen on the ground that she had only been asked about the front room. And frankly, the fact that she thinks that she can say yes, I mean, they're saying, do you mind if we do? And she's like, no, yes, go ahead. That doesn't mean she has authority to do that. And I think Rodriguez says that, when it's, you can't rely on somebody saying that they, for example, that this is my room or this is whatever. If circumstances indicate otherwise, or if it's ambiguous, and that's what the Whitfield case says, then the questioning has to take place. And there was no questioning. Here we have a one-bedroom apartment in which two people are clearly sleeping in different rooms. The living room is not being used, as far as we can tell, as there is no evidence that she used that room. No evidence at all.
How do you reconcile this with Harrison? In Harrison, don't we have facts that go against you?
I thought in Harrison it was a husband and wife who, of course, I think have different privacy expectations vis-a-vis each other than the great-great-grandmother and the grandson. But also I thought that boxes were stored in an area that was specifically designated or said to be an area where both people stored things. I mean, this is something Ms. Hicks said. That's where he keeps his stuff. That's why the officer says he went over to the bed and looked in that box, because that's where he kept his stuff. And the issue of the kitchen,
I think from your perspective, it's the shoebox is no different from a locked container that was labeled Davon's stuff.
Absolutely. And I do want to say one thing that seems to have been missed in this case is that, poor people have privacy rights too. And the government seems to want him to have a locked door or to put it in a closet or a strong box or a footlocker. And the practical reality is that, if someone can't afford that, doesn't have those things, poor people respect each other's privacy too, and they make do with what they have. And
but if it's a shoebox in the middle of the living room, for example, then why wouldn't one normally assume that both of them had equal access to it? And whatever privacy, even if it turned out to have been his, whatever privacy interest he may have had in it, he assumed the risk that she would assert joint dominion and control over it, or at least be perceived as having.
Well, I think access is different than use, and I think that you can't assume that in this case. That's what I think Whitfield is saying. You have to ask. It may be that she went in that room and that box.
So you think any shoebox anywhere in the living room, the police had to ask before opening it? It doesn't have to do with the fact that this one was found next to the bed.
Obviously, that makes it a stronger situation for us, yes. But I do think that when it appears to be the bedroom, I mean, the government focuses on walking through the kitchen. But the kitchen, I believe the diagram shows that really you just turn from the hall and the door is on the front wall there, the living room. You don't have to enter the interior of that front room in order to get in. And I also want to make the point that, we acknowledge that if you can see things, so yes, to go to the kitchen, she would be able to see into the living room. And if there was something out in the open,
well,
we would be
saying this. The diagram I'm looking at has a door going from the living room into the kitchen. And I don't see, it looks like a front closet.
Right. I think you go in, and I think there's a closet here, and then you just make that turn, and then the door is right there, whereas the living room is over here. You're not going through the living room. You're just turning the corner, and the front wall of the living room is the way I saw the diagram.
All right. That triangle, do you have that drawing?
I don't have it yet.
The triangle to the above and to the right of the front door. That's a door opening, but isn't it the door opening to the closet? I don't see any opening into the kitchen except from the living room.
Right, but I see. I agree with that. But what I'm saying is you go down that hall, you make a right, you go right into the kitchen, quick right again. You're just going around the corner.
Yeah,
you're not walking through the living room.
You're going right through the living room.
I mean, you are in part of the living room, but you are not you're not going through the living room through his area. In other words, and again, I think people, in respect to people's privacy, it's not clear. And to me, it seems analogous to with the issue of walking through is, roommates sometimes have their door open and someone might be able to see in, and things that you can see, if you see a gun on the dresser, I think the roommate could say, yeah, go on in. If you can see it, but if there's a closed bureau in there, and that's sort of the situation we have here, and I don't think anyone would think, that the vice versa here would be true, that, she sleeps in the bedroom and keeps her stuff presumably in a dresser. He sleeps in the living room and keeps his stuff in boxes and bags, and I don't think the police would think he could consent, without asking.
If there's a TV in the living room, suppose a TV in the living room, and the TV sits on top of the cabinet, mm-hmm. we would rationally assume that everybody who's an occupant in the house watches TV in the living room. So if she consents to a search of the living room, is there anything wrong with officers looking in the cabinet on which the TV rests?
The government had the burden to put that in the record, I guess is what I'm saying. If there's a TV in her room.
I understand the scope of your argument because I'm obviously giving you a hypothetical. But
right.
If the parameter surrounding the particular place that was searched would lead one to assume that both of them actually used that area
mm-hmm.
like a TV cabinet, then I take it you would have no issue with a search premised on her consent to search the living room.
I think if the record revealed, evidence from which you could infer that she did use that area, yes. But there is nothing like that here. And if there was no TV and he said, do you use this living room? And she said yes, or there was no... I think it's unique circumstances because of her age, her disability, the fact that she stays in her room, the fact that it's a one-bedroom apartment being slept in by two different people. It's much more like a two-bedroom apartment that she doesn't necessarily need or use the living room. I mean, frankly, there's no evidence she went to the kitchen as opposed to someone bringing her meals. I mean, I'm just saying that as an example of how the record is so empty here, and I don't think the police, had any basis to believe one way or the other.
She wasn't bedridden.
Came to court. She came to court, I believe, on a scooter, and there was testimony about a walker in her room as well. So it's unclear that she always had to be on the mechanical device or not, but I mean... As far as, you mentioned furniture in the living room, we don't know what the layout was. Defense counsel tried to establish what the layout of the living room was and where exactly things were found and was prevented from doing that. And it may be that the scooter did not even, get over to that area. There was a coffee table blocking. I mean, who knows? I'm just saying, given the burden, unfortunately for the government, they did not meet it here. And it is, I think, very much controlled by Whitfield. The other cases we cite, all that case law is on our side. The government attempts to distinguish the cases in a footnote, but really when you read their parentheticals, it's not clear to me why they think these cases are distinguishable even.
Well, I think Harrison emphasizes access, and that, and you mentioned the difference between access and use, and I think Harrison saying that they had, the husband and wife had equal access, it was not, in other words, Harrison seemed to emphasize there was no keep out, this is mine, no initials, anything like that, that's what makes this close to Harrison, in that there's no way the police, I don't think, had been told that shoebox was off limits, and how they would assume it was off limits just because it was near the bed and she said that's where he sleeps or that's where he keeps his things.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think where the burden is on them to show authority.
Right.
And I also
right.
think that Harrison, if my memory of it is that they talked, that it was both people were using, it was a closet under a stairwell.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the record established that both husband and wife used that closet to store their things. This is very different. I mean, Ms. Hicks says this is where he puts his things. And so I...
Okay. All right. We'll give you a couple. Judge Griffith, do you have any more questions?
No.
Okay,
thank you.
Ms. Park?
May it please the Court, Ann Park on behalf of the United States, and I'd like to also focus my argument on the shoebox search and Ms. Hicks's authority and submit with respect to the remaining issues on our brief. And I understand it is the government's burden to prove by a preponderance that Ms. Hicks had the authority to consent. The problem was, as we argue in our brief, that this was not properly raised before the district court. The party's attention was not alerted to this specific issue of the shoebox, and so the record is very sparse. If I could just begin about what the record actually shows. The testimony at the hearing is very sparse. It's basically the officer testifies that the drugs were found in a shoebox, it was on the ground, and it was in the living room. And he testifies that he couldn't remember if there was a bed or a couch, but that's where he understood the defendant slept, and the party stipulated on occasion only.
I thought there was more than that. The record said it was next to the bed, right?
I'm sorry. In the hearing, there was no discussion of where exactly the shoebox was. I believe the next to the bed comes from the government's opposition. In our written opposition, we write the drugs were found in a shoebox near the bed or next to the bed, and that's the living room area was where the defendant kept his personal property in bags and boxes. That's solely based on the government's written opposition.
Now, it's based on the officer's affidavit, I thought.
Yes, the officer's affidavit also, that's a second place where next to the bed, and it's described as a bed here, next to the bed. And then the only evidence in the record as to... only evidence that might suggest that the area near the bed was a place that was designated where Mr. Payton kept his stuff is the affidavit. And that's on page 59 of the joint appendix. And it's the first line of the summary. On Tuesday, July 14th, the woman who was a tenant of apartment 620 permitted me to search the area of a bed in the living room, which a tenant said her grandson used. Now, I think this is a lot for appellant to hang his hat on to say.
But on page 60, then, maybe we're going to get this on page 60. The officer says,
yes.
I saw a shoebox lying on the floor next to
Payton's bed. I picked up the box and opened it. So that is the extent of the evidence in this record about the shoebox. And the reason why the evidence was so sparse is because when appellant, if I could just go through procedurally, his motion was very general. He admitted it. Basically said the searches were warrantless and therefore unconstitutional. At the beginning of the hearing, if you look at page 5 to 6 of the July 22nd transcript, the district court actually she's trying to figure out, well, should I have an evidentiary hearing on this? And she's pushing the defense counsel to state more specifically, what are your arguments? And if you look on page 6, you don't have anything specific to attack it. This is line 15. And if I make an officer testify, that's just giving you discovery. Defense counsel says, we believe, Your Honor, that with the officer's testimony, very likely Ms. Hicks's testimony, the evidence will be before the court that will show that the consent was not voluntary. It was not valid. It was not knowing. That is the only specific argument he raised before evidence was put on. Then Officer Modlin testifies, and during the cross-examination of Modlin, there's a suggestion by defense counsel that he might start questioning the authority of Ms. Hicks to consent to the living room area. But if you look at, and I would direct the court to pages 40 to 43 is essentially where it is, the questions are directed as to where specifically the location of the items are, and the court allows that testimony. But then the questions are directed toward, did the defendant use the bedroom as a living area? Or were there things in the living area that looked like it was someone's bedroom? And the court cuts off defense counsel and says, look, the government has already conceded that point, that Mr. Payton used the living room area, used the living room in general, as his bedroom, and he slept there. And then the party stipulated that he slept there on occasion. And there was nothing from the defense suggesting that he stayed there all the time. It was merely he slept there sometimes on occasion. That was it. And if you look at the argument section, when they start actually arguing about common authority, the defendant argues on page 94, page 95 about common authority. And the defense counsel basically says, this is on line 17, on page 95, Ms. Hicks doesn't really leave her bedroom, and so we just think that there is an issue of whether she had common authority to consent to the search of that area that is not a common area.
Above that, though, he says, this was Davon's, the defendant's area of where he slept and kept his belongings, and it's more than that. It's his home as well. It's not just where he stores his belongings. That's his home.
Yes. But
so they're concentrating on the area where she said that's where he sleeps and keeps his stuff.
But it was, she never, there's no indication in the record that she was particularly designating the area around the day bed as opposed to the living room area in general. I don't think there's anything in the record besides the one line in the affidavit. And defense counsel, you know, when they were using this affidavit below, they entered it for the purpose of showing that Ms. Hicks's consent on July 14th was only to the living room area, not to the kitchen. And the court, if you look at the ruling, relied on this to suppress the contents of the stuff in the kitchen. So nobody was even focused on this issue, and that might help to explain why there's no record. And so we would argue that this has not been properly preserved first, that it should be waived or at the very least plain error. And in any event, even if the court doesn't buy our preservation arguments, I think there is enough in this record to show that she did have the apparent authority.
Did you make an argument in your brief that if you assume that it was preserved such that plain error doesn't apply, that you should still advance to the shoebox?
I thought I did. I thought I did.
That, but maybe you did. I thought that you rested it all on plain error.
Oh.
You tell me if I'm wrong.
Your Honor, if that's the way it came across, I'd have to look specifically, but generally we argue even if it's not plain error, and that's what we would argue here. And I apologize if it's not clear in the brief, but there's enough on this record, even though it's sparse. We would say it's appellant's fault for not raising it properly, but... basically, you have a shoebox, as Your Honor indicated. It's lying on the ground in the living room. There's no indication that it is his specifically. There's no indication that it's even in an area with the rest of his personal belongings. If there's anything in the record to suggest that he kept his personal belongings in a special place or there's a particular portion of the room where he used it, that would be at least help them to get over the hump of showing that he has retained some sort of exclusivity or control over the shoebox.
The shoebox were found on the bed. Same argument?
On the bed, it was called a day bed. They didn't know whether it was a sofa or a couch. I would even, if it was under the bed, secreted in some way, cases have sort of hinged on that fact, that shows that the owner of the shoebox doesn't want people getting into his business. But if it's simply on a day bed, because it seems as though the day bed was used as a couch and his where he slept at night. And I would.
But then why would that make a difference if it were under? Because if it were a couch, that wouldn't give me any more indication that it was his as opposed to hers, whether it's under or on top of.
Your Honor, I think the notion that it's if someone takes the effort to put an item under, out of sight, away from plain view, there's this notion that they're trying to retain an expectation of privacy in it, versus if it's actually just on top of the couch. We would argue here, I mean, this is a place where he slept on occasion, and it was a common area, it was a living room, and I understand their arguments. I mean, it's a small one-bedroom apartment, and that's what the judge kept harping on. And if you look at the record, and the court actually found this was remained a common area, despite the fact that he slept there on occasion. And if you look at the record, even though the police didn't know this when they entered the apartment July 14th, on January 20th, the second search, when they arrived at the apartment, there were actually the appellant's girlfriend and a third unidentified male were found in the apartment, and they were all in the living room. I mean, this is all to suggest where else in the apartment, a one-bedroom apartment, are you going to go when you have guests? And the only place is that living room or the kitchen, that open area. And so I think Mr. Payton assumed the risk that if Ms. Hicks allowed visitors or guests access into the room, or his girlfriend allowed visitors and access into the room, into the apartment, they would end up in the living room or the kitchen. And anything he kept there, if he did not secrete it or try to show that he was trying to keep it as something that he wanted to exert control over, it's fair game. And it was reasonable to the officers to believe that. And for these reasons, we would ask that the district court's order be affirmed if there are no further questions from the court.
Judge Griffith?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't you take a minute?
Thank you. On the preservation issue, I do think we went through all that in quite a bit of detail in the reply, and the court clearly entertained Mr. Miles' asserted the voluntariness issue before the hearing. He was just trying to get the hearing, and that was sufficient to get the hearing. That wasn't saying that's the only thing we're going to argue, and obviously at the end they argued many, many, many things given the time constraints and then expanded it, and the court totally entertained that, ruled on it, rejected the entire premise of the argument that we make now. As far as the securing of the box, I mean, there was a lid on the box. You don't have to, no more than the grandmother would have to put a lock on your bureau drawer and put a sign saying, keep out. Does he have to do that in order to do the same here? We don't even know if there is space under the bed. And I think the point is that all the speculation just points out how ambiguous the situation is. And unfortunately, we just don't have, the police did not establish the record or ask the questions as Whitfield requires. On the on-occasion thing, I think I deal with that in the brief, but, I mean, that is not what the stipulation was at all. It was at least on occasion, which is obviously literally true when you're there every night, and that was the assertion that he lived there. That was his home. I think I also want to say about the fruit, that the government doesn't really dispute that the gun is the fruit of the shoebox, other than to sort of conclusively say that the same arguments that apply to their fruit argument on the kitchen stuff also applies to the shoebox. And I think it is different because at that point he's being arrested for the shoebox stuff. The cat is out of the bag, and I think there's clearly a causal connection that's just absolute. He's being arrested for that material. And I don't think they've met their burden of showing the attenuation that would be required. For that reason, we'd ask for all the evidence to be suppressed.
Judge Griffith?
No, I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.